This is Brian Holmes, interviewed via Skype by Chris Alden Lee on the 14th of May 2013. Brian Holmes, Part 1.
Brian Holmes, don't forget the Y and the Brian, was born in Church Stretton, Shropshire, 17th of May 1932.
So how old are you now, Brian?
80, I'll be 81 on Friday.
Happy birthday. You're speaking from Canada, where you moved at some point.
Yes. We moved to Canada in 1968 and spent the first few years. It was quite interesting. We spent the first few years in an isolated part in the Rockies. We were building all the infrastructure for a new coal mine and the railway lines that connected it into the mainstream. And believe it or not, we actually lived in a log cabin that one of the original homesteaders had used. My first winter in Canada, the temperature got dropped down to minus 44 Fahrenheit, which was colder than I ever had it in the Antarctic.
Tell me about your father. Would you say he was an educated man?
Actually, we didn't. My mother divorced my father at a very early age. I didn't see very much of him, and I was virtually brought up by my mother. My father eventually remarried and moved back to Church Stretton, and in my later years, when I was in my 20s and that sort of thing, we re-established contact. But in my earlier years, I saw very, very little of him.
What kind of education did he have, Brian?
Me?
Yeah.
First of all, the Oxford School certificate at the Priory School for Boys. I won a scholarship to the from Church Stretton to the Priory School for Boys in Shrewsbury. Then I spent 3 years as an articled pupil to the county surveyor, basically in the highways department, roads and bridges was the main focus of our work. And then later I spent 1 year doing a one-year diploma course at University College London in survey. And coincidentally on the same course were two other ex-FIDs, Norman Leppard and Peter Gibbs.
Well,
there were three ex-FIDs out of a total of seven in the course.
Let's come back to that later on. What was it, do you think, that drew you towards surveying as a career?
I think two things. One, I was always interested in geography and travel, and it sort of combined with surveying. It combined quite a bit of outdoors work, of course, together with office was doing the compilations and plotting of the surveys, etc. So seemed to be quite a nice combination of outside and inside work.
What sort of things were you doing at Shropshire County Council?
Basically doing surveys for new roads and, you know, realignments and we did the preliminary work for a lot of the bypasses whereby the county council could, from the planning point of view, that they wouldn't allow new buildings, new development on the line of potential bypasses. And so we surveyed the routes. Let me think. Ludlow Bypass, Bridge North Bypass, Shrewsbury Bypass, Oswestry.
Yeah, yeah. They've even, these days, they've even bypassed the bypass in Shrewsbury.
So I believe, yeah.
What do you think was your first awareness that there was a place on this planet called Antarctica?
I think, actually, it was very, very probably, we're going back a few years now, but I think it was very probably number one, the film Scott of the Antarctic with John Mills, etc. And I think in 1953, too, there was the ascent of Everest. And, you know, they, I think those two combined sort of, I thought it would be quite an adventurous undertaking, being in the land of snow and ice and et cetera, et cetera. That probably triggered it off.
What's the story of you then finding out about the possibility of going there and applying to FIDS? Bless you.
Well, I had read quite a bit about it. I'd seen the occasional references in the newspaper to the two FIDS, the Falkland Island Dependency Survey, and, you know, that John Biscoe was departing with scientists to head south, etc. So that had triggered my interest. And then I was playing rugby for Shrewsbury, and a newcomer arrived by the name of John Green, who was at that time engaged to a Shrewsbury girl, Doreen. Much to my surprise and delight, I found that he had just returned from the Antarctic. He had been at Base B, Deception Island. He was quite a few years older than me at that time. But he told, you know, when we talked about the potential of going to the Antarctic, he sort of gave me the names of the contacts, Bill Sloman, who was the, I guess, the chief recruiting officer at the time, and told me to keep my eyes open on the Times and the Telegraph for advertisements and then respond accordingly. How old would I be at that time? 21, something like 22. Mm-hmm. And so I added the Times to my newspaper deliveries, and sure enough, there was the advertisement from the Crown agents. So I made the application and had interviews, and away it went from there.
What did you make of Johnny Green, who later became Sec FIDS, didn't he?
I liked him. I thought he was a very enthusiastic guy. I think that he's, with some of his contemporaries, he wasn't, how do I put it? I think he maybe suffered a little bit by the fact that he hadn't done any of the major long-distance sledge journeys such as Ray Hady and Bunny Fuchs had done. He had, you know, nothing of his doing, but he had been more or less confined to bases without the sledging tradition. And I think that some of the contemporaries, for want of a better word, sort of, you know, downplayed the fact, well, he hasn't done a heck of a lot of sledging. And I think he suffered a little bit from that.
Mm-hmm. Was he a good rugby player?
Yes, pretty good. He played centre three quarter. I played wing forward.
And did he marry Doreen?
Yes, he did. And she was one of three very, very, very attractive girls in in Shrewsbury. So when John was engaged to Doreen, we were all sort of looking for the possibility of sort of making contact with the other two girls, but nothing came of it. and she spent several, many years in Port Stanley, I believe.
Oh, Mrs. Green?
Yes.
All right. Doing what, Brian?
Yeah.
Doing what?
Well, with John being a Sec FIDS and Doreen, you know, just being there in support, John eventually became Sec FIDS. Actually, the year that I went down there, in 1956, I think.
Okay. So tell me about this application then. Were you successful straight away to applying to FIDS?
Pretty well. I think what helped was the fact that I had been very enthusiastic about the Antarctic, had read quite a lot about it. I think they were impressed by the fact that I had actually subscribed to and took delivery of the Polar Record, which was then the journal of the Scott Polar Research Institute. And I think that was very probably rare amongst their applicants that people had gone to that extent and had researched the Antarctic.
Done your homework.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you remember of the interview? I appreciate it was a long time ago, but do you recall it at all?
Well, my recollection was that it was Bill Sloman, Brian Roberts, you know, asking questions about my training and background and competence, if you like, as a surveyor. And but I think it really helped the fact that I had for quite a long time shown quite an interest in the Antarctic. They told me that they gave an idea as to the sort of work that would be involved, the number of surveyors and geologists that they were hoping to recruit that year. I think at that time we've got this was, it just so happened that this turned out to be the IGY, International Geophysical Year, but up from which Antarctica became virtually an international area. But prior to that, there had been the conflicting claims for territory in Graham Land at that time from Chile and Argentina, and there was a possibility that the case would be taken to the Hague to settle the land claims. So I think at that time Britain was pushing for completing high quality maps of the area together with geological surveys in order to back up their potential claim through the international court.
The motivation then was as much political as it was simply for the sake of being an explorer.
From the Foreign Office's point of view, I think that was probably the case, yeah.
Were you aware of that at the time, do you think?
Yes, I don't think we were. There was anything hidden about it. I think it was just, to back up our claim, we're going to show, A, that we've got a major year-round occupation of the territory, which Chile and Argentina didn't have at that time. B, the number of bases and the number of people that were down there, and C, the amount of exploration and mapping that was being undertaken. Mm. The Chileans and Argentinians at that time virtually, I think their attitude, they put people on bases, but they didn't carry out an awful lot of, hardly any sledging, and not an awful lot of scientific work. You know, they did met reports and that sort of thing, but not very much research into upper atmosphere and that sort of thing that we were doing.
Now, do you feel that your work on bypasses in Shropshire was ideal training for surveying Antarctic coastlands, or did you have to go off and learn a new part of your trade?
Well, if you've been up on top of the Longmynd on a windy day. it was the thing that I found that I enjoyed with the Roads and Bridges Department was the actual survey and mapping and using the surveying instruments, you know, the theodolite levels, that sort of thing, measurement. I think that I enjoyed the whole aspect of it, but I think that one was, that was probably the part that I enjoyed most of all. Mm. So the use of instruments became reasonably proficient at it over a period of 3 years, sort of thing.
Nevertheless, I think you were sent off to do some training before you went south. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Tell me about that, Brian.
Okay, we went to what at that time was the Department of Overseas Surveys, Directorate of Overseas Surveys, which was at Tolworth in Surrey. We were, I think there were probably about four surveyors at that time. but who were designated to go to the Antarctic, and we were given a virtually an overview of the area. At the particular time, Hunting Aero Surveys that were under contract to fly air photographs for mapping the length and breadth of Graham Land. So we did have a certain number of air photographs to look at, and using stereoscopes to see the you know, the contours, that sort of thing. And then so we were given and quite a bit of research into the potential bases that we might be going to, and which varied from Cygni Island, Admiralty Bay, and then there's several of the bases that further south, south of the circle of Horseshoe Bay, Detail Islet, and there was a gap in this potential survey, partly because of the sea ice current, or the currents and the ocean currents which prevented the formation of sea ice. So there was a gap between virtually Anvers Island, the Argentine Islands, and which was base F at that time, and the north end of Adelaide Island. And that this part had, was inaccessible, and it was intended to establish a new base somewhere along that coastline in order to provide the link.
This is an area that we haven't, that the FIDs hadn't got to at that point, isn't it?
Yeah. So having been given, spent quite a bit of time on the background researching work that had been done there before, in particularly the where the potential base J was going, the BGLE, the British Graham Land Expedition of 1936-37, you know, we were able to research the work that they had done. So that gave us a background into the area that we were likely to go. And then from there, we then went under Alfred Stevenson, who was the senior lecturer in survey at Imperial College London. We went down and had a two-week survey camp in Ascot, where we were introduced to the position fixing by astronomy, which wasn't something that was you would normally undertake in Great Britain at that time.
Yeah.
So we did quite a lot of work under Steve on astrofixes. This is, of course, before the days of GPS. Petrosel was the our main contact at DOS. She did an excellent job of providing us with all the background information to the areas that we were going to. And I'm pleased to see that she's still involved in some ways with the BAS Club.
Well, I'm reading her notes now as part of the research for this interview, and she tells me that you were quite a stunner back in the 60s and 50s.
Oh. Didn't seem to get anywhere.
No, sadly not. There were people on this course with you, I think, including Peter Gibbs and Angus Erskine. Do those names ring bells?
That's right, yes. And Peter and I became good friends. I went to his wedding, one of the ushers at his wedding. And we also, when, as I said, coincidentally, we found ourselves on the same survey course at University College London, and together jointly, two of the tasks that we had to do, to the fieldwork task, one of them was a fairly detailed survey on a large scale. So he came to Church Stretton with me, and together we surveyed the farm belonging to, again, one of my former rugby players. So we spent quite some time doing that. And then we had to do a triangulation and plain table survey on the Isle of Wight. Most people stayed in hotels, the other class members. Peter and I pitched a mountain tent on one of the cliff tops there and conducted our survey from there. Angus was also on the course. Beg your pardon, he was also at the DOS doing the... we met some of them doing some of the preliminary work there. And at the end of the... when we returned back to England, Angus and I shared an apartment in just off Regent's Park when we were working at DOS doing the compilation of the maps. A little bit later on, he, Tom Murphy, who had been his predecessor's base leader at Base W, and I headed off to Scandinavia, and we had about 3 or 4 months working our way up the Norwegian coast from the Jotunheim up over the Arctic Circle into northern Sweden, and climbing on the way, and we climbed Kebnekaise, which was the highest mountain in Scandinavia at that time, and then found a way back to the UK and went our separate ways. Mm-hmm.
So. Petrosol suggests that the Biscay was delayed on that journey of 1956. That was the year you went, isn't it?
Yes.
And that you and Peter and Angus had lots of spare time on your hands, which was not always used productively.
Well, what happened was, in fact, it was partly a political thing, is that it was the maiden voyage of the John Biscoe at that time. It just so happened that the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip, was doing a tour of the southern hemisphere and the British possessions and contacts there. He had been, I think, to an opening of the Olympic Games in Australia on board the Britannia. And part of there, they visited quite a few of the minor possessions, such as Ascension Island and Tristan da Cunha, and had expressed a desire to go to the Antarctic as well. So the John Biscoe was delayed somewhat so that its journey partly could coincide with Prince Philip's visit there. And as a result, we'd finished our course and we had about 3 weeks before the ship was going to leave. So I think to get us out of her hair, I think Petra sent us up to Aviemore in Scotland to do some climbing and working this crevasse rescues in the crevasses on the Cairngorm Mountain. So we spent 3 weeks up in Aviemore. It was then run by the Scottish Council of Physical Recreation.
Glenmore Lodge,
that was exactly it. Yes.
Yeah. And did that crevasse rescue training come in handy ever?
Well, believe it, there was snow there at this time of year. I think it must have been late October or something of that sort. So we tried our hand at skiing, not very successfully, and did a few. We found a couple of ravines and we pretended that they were crevasses and did some rescue work out of these ravines. And while we were there, one of the permanent instructors who were there, George McLeod, sort of was envious of us heading down to the Antarctic. So he said, well, why don't you apply? Because we need general assistance and mountaineers, that sort of thing. He said, oh, they wouldn't have taken any notice of me. We said, well, you know, apply anyway. And then much to his surprise and our delight, he did have an interview. There was an opening and George was recruited, and he actually flew. The ship had already left. All this was late in the season, and I believe he flew down to Montevideo and joined the ship there.
So tell me then about the departure on the Biscoe and the journey south, Brian.
Well, it was quite interesting. The first four, number one, the it, as I said, it was the maiden voyage of the ship. from my my own humorous point of view, there'd been a just so happened that in Church Stretton there'd been a quite a big social occasion. Was the Hunt Ball, so I thought, oh, that'll be a good send off. We'll go to that one. And that was actually the night before we actually had to get to Southampton. So attended this, to be resplendent in dinner jacket, etc. Probably overindulged myself. went back home. So I had to catch a midnight train from Shrewsbury to London, Southampton. And so quickly changed. Fortunately, I had all my things packed, everything else. Got onto the train, went to sleep, got off to make the connection at London to go on to Southampton. Looked down to my storage, resplendent in a brown sports jacket, brown slacks, and I still had on my black patent leather shoes from the night before. We departed okay, and Mike Smith, who was the second officer, Kelly Johnson was the skipper. Mike Smith sort of appointed me as the King Fid on board the Biscoe. You know, what a big deal.
I was really intrigued by that, because it was your first time with Fids, and yet you were appointed King Fid. Can you remember why that was?
Not the slightest idea, no. No, I haven't got the slightest idea. But it worked out well. Mike and I got on quite well. another funny thing, as I was said on the John Briscoe, I'd got somewhat of a hangover from the night before, and I'd made this connection. The last train to Southampton was a little bit late, but... And I can't remember the time, but say you were expected to report it to the on board at 10 o'clock. Well, I didn't get there till 10:45 because of the train connections. So when I got on board with my head throbbing, Mike Smith looked up and he said, "You must be Brian Holmes." He said, "You're bloody late." I said, "I'm bloody lucky to be here at all." But. And the first 4 days, we were going through the Bay of Biscay, and it sort of lived up to its reputation for having bad weather. And one by one, people sort of succumbed to the weather and the waves. And it left only, I think, of all the people on board, there were only five of us that very fortunately weren't seasick. And... Then as the days got better, then all of you know, other faces start appearing you hadn't seen before, and the rest of the journey was quite good. We in fact, it was a non-stop trip to Montevideo. We would normally, I think there'd been some problems at the sea trials with the Biscoe as well, and it had to miss out what had been a planned routine trip to Ascension Island. This was normal, apparently, for the ships heading south to call in at Ascension on the way down. And we had to forego that and went straight to Montevideo to stock up there. We had maybe 2 days in Monte, 2 or 3 days. And then on to Port Stanley, where we rendezvoused with the Britannia.
Well, so what was the Biscoe like? I guess you weren't a seasoned sailor.
It was fairly slow. I say fairly slow. I think it was incredibly slow. It was probably about 10 knots was our average speed, I think. I go that fast, I'm a sailboat. But reasonably comfortable. I think it was an improvement on what, I'm sure it was an improvement on the old Bisco. We had bunks, individual cabins with two bunks in it, so you shared with someone else. We were, at that time, we were told that we had to sign on as supernumeraries to the crew. We were told that this was to make sure we didn't have to have it made it easier when we got to Montevideo and any other potential foreign ports of call, that as supernumeraries to the crew, it was easy to get through customs and immigration in transit. In fact, after we had got through the Bay of Biscay, Mike Smith said, well, you're supernumeraries to the crew, so now you have to work. So they put us all to work. I mean, hey, this is a brand new ship straight from John Brown's on the Clyde. But put us to work repainting everything. At that time, the ship was, I believe later on, they were changed to red or some striking colour, but at that time they were grey. But I recall that we were all, and I've got photographs of us painting on swing stages, hanging from the masts, painting the masts, the bridge, creosoting the deck and all the rest of it. So anyway, it kept us occupied on the way down. It was kept us a little bit out of trouble, I suppose.
What were your duties as King Fid then? Did he have any special responsibilities?
Other than allocating people to do, so Mike Smith would give us the work that had to be done. And I would sort of allocate different people to do different jobs. And most people, everyone complied, you know, it was a way of keeping occupied on the way down there. I think it also included helping out in the galley, which wasn't a very popular job, but somebody had to do it, as they say. The cabin boy was quite something. He was Kelly Johnson was a skipper, and I think I can't remember the name of the cabin boy, but he was a typical Glaswegian. He'd been working in the shipyard, and Kelly had taken a liking to him and offered him a job as a cabin boy, and he was a typical Glaswegian, so didn't stand any nonsense from anybody, no matter if they were a top scientist or what. We're all equal on this, and he was quite a character.
Some FIDs say that the journey south is very important because you tend to bond with your colleagues on the way down.
I'm sure that was the case, yes. In some cases, people knew exactly which base they were going to and what work they were doing, and met other people going to the same base. I think that was, in the majority of cases, that was. And it was, I'm sure it was an important factor that you knew that we were going to be together for a minimum of a year and possibly two. And I think the one thing that I learned and most of us learned was to be tolerant of others, you know, that might have a different point of view to yours. But, you were going to be together for a year or more, and you had to understand their point of view and optimistically hope that they would understand your point of view, even if it was different sort of thing. I think that one learned quite a lot of tolerance in my spell there.
Did you take to it? Because it's very, very different from the County Shire Hall in Shrewsbury Square, isn't it? The environment you were heading for.
Exactly, yes. But as I said, I'd read quite a lot about it, and you know, was reasonably well prepared to what to expect, I think. And luckily, the six of us that were at base together all got on well together. There was no friction between us, so it worked out quite well. I think, you know, the same thing. The other people learned to be tolerant as well, and put up with my idiosyncrasies the same as I did theirs, I suppose. So,
when did you find out where you were going to go?
Well, I knew before we left that I was going to the new Base J, but what we didn't know was where Base J was going to be located. We knew it was going to be south of the Argentine Islands and north of Base W, which was on Detail Island. But we had to find, we knew that we were going to have to find a base, and optimistically we were hoping that it would be on the mainland and not on one of the islands, where obviously you're restricted because of the, you have to wait for the sea ice. Mm. So other than knowing the general area I was going, you know, we didn't know specifically what the location was going to be.
Let's come to that shortly. Tell me about your arrival at Port Stanley and coming in alongside the Britannia.
Yeah, that was interesting. We were, again, everyone learned whether you were going to be an ornithologist on at Admiralty Bay or whether you were going to be a general assistant in further south. You knew that the work had to be done, so we all buckled down and we had to offload the supplies from the John Briscoe. They were transported up to the general store and then resorted when the ship's eventual route was determined, so that the first base that you were going to visit was on top and the last base you got to visit was at the bottom. So all this all had to be taken out, taken ashore, resorted, reloaded. So it was fairly heavy physical work that everyone buckled in to do. And we found the Falkland Islanders were fabulous. A lot of, you know, great fun, very hard workers, very good seamen. But, you know, we all worked as stevedores, you might say, on the thing. And while we were there, Prince Philip arrived on the Britannia. There were a couple of three receptions, and he also took part in the horse race.
Tell me about that. Did you see it?
Yes. So with the reception, the funny thing is it was at the town hall, and needed to say it was a dress-up affair, and we drew lots. There were going to be four Fids were invited to take part in this official reception. And so we actually drew lots to see who the four were going to be, and I lucked out as being one of them. Angus Erskine lucked out as being another one. So we had a hard day's work offloading the ship, and went to the Port Stanley pub with the crew to slake our thirst. And said, "Oh, good Lord, we've got to be at the reception in half an hour." So dashed back to the ship, changed. Of course, there's no transport there. Ran down the dock, ran down the road, got to the reception about 5 minutes before Prince Philip did, and to find that the doors were virtually closed and everyone was all anxiously awaiting the arrival of the royal party. So they had to open the doors to let Angus and myself in. The only way down into the hall was down the red carpet, down the centre of the room. So we did the royal salute, waving to the crowd as we walked through the car. And then about 5 minutes later, the royal entourage arrived, and that was that. Then they had, it was the annual Port Stanley Day and their races. It was a big event. So they found a horse for Prince Philip, and obviously a pretty fast one. And I think quite legitimately he won the race. I don't think the others held back, but it was quite something, quite a day's entertainment there.
Did the whole island turn out?
Oh, yes, yes.
And did you meet His Royal Highness?
Yeah, because what happened then, we then went on, went our separate ways. We went to South Georgia, onto Deception Island, and then just south of Deception Island, the Britannia had also visited some of the northern bases, not accompanied by us. But then he transferred from the Britannia onto the Biscoe at sea. And before he did that, his ADC, Mike, someone, I'll think of his name in a minute, came on board to give us, make everyone aware of the protocol involved. So the skipper said, you know, well, anything that I should do about polishing everything up and making everything spick and span. And Mike said, now look, he said, Prince Philip has spent many, many years at sea. He said, there's nothing that you can do in a day which is going to impress him any more. That, you know, he knows how a ship operates and he knows bits get rusty and that sort of thing. So you don't make any special arrangements at all. He said, what about food? Same thing applies, no special arrangements. So Prince Philip transferred at sea onto the onto our ship, and I was still King Fid, so I had to introduce him to all the members of the of Fid who were going down to the bases and that sort of thing. And he said he was on board for 3 days, I would think, three, four days. And he shared his time eating between the wardroom and with us as the Fids. And the one funny thing I remember, a couple of funny things, was when he first came on board and introduced him, he said, is it cocktail hour yet? So, oh, yes, what would you like, sir? Oh, and the other thing Mike said was that you'd address him as sir, not your highness or not something, just address him as sir all the time. So at the one meal we were having, a lot of people were in their early stages of growing beards, including Prince Philip. And so I think it was Vince O'Neill, one of the radio operators, said to him, talking about beards and this, so he said, well, what about your beard, sir? Are you going to keep that on when you get back to England? And Prince Philip sort of fingered the stubble on his chin and said, I don't know. He said, I'd quite like to, he said, but let's face it, it depends what the wife says.
So you got on with him quite well then, did you? Did he impress you then?
Oh, yeah. It's very much... the impression, you know, very much one of the boys, but absolutely no side to him whatsoever. You know, it was easy to talk to, easy to get along with, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Did you have to salute him in the corridor?
No. The furthest south he went was 2 Base W, which was just south of the Antarctic Circle. I think that was the big thing about it. And he wanted to get all sorts of records. So he actually went out and played tennis on the ice for a outside Base W. So at least he could claim in the potential Guinness Book of Records of played tennis further south than anyone else. So
I was reading they had to change the rules to allow lobbing.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about the arrival then at Prospect Point, because have they chosen the exact base position by then?
Yeah. we searched, again, we'd had a couple of interesting things, was that before we set off from Britain, as I said, there was the Hunting Aero Surveys had a two-year contract to fly photographs over the Graham Land, as cover as much of it as it could. In year one, they'd had atrocious weather, lots of low cloud cover, etc., etc., and had only been able to fly about 10% of their contracted area. So we were virtually told before we left UK, well, you have this aero survey company down there, but you could virtually ignore them because they're not being, you know, the weather isn't suitable and they're not achieving very much. In fact, when we arrived at Deception Island, which is where their operating base was, you know, they had float planes that could operate off the from inside the island. They had had a long spell of very good weather, and they had in fact completed 100% of their flights. So now all of a sudden we had to change our prospective plans of, you know, doing the normal sledge wheel traverses and plane table surveys, but optimistically controlled by a triangulation. Just now we had air photographs of the whole of our section of Graham Land, and we were to provide ground control to identify certain points on the photographs that would prove the basis of the new maps there. So we now had photographs of the whole coastline. So we were able to pinpoint two or three prospective areas that looked as if they would be on the mainland, that looked as if they could provide access further inland as well. So that helped immensely that, you know, we checked out the first couple that weren't very satisfactory and then eventually picked out Prospect Point, and that's where we established the base. But that was with the aid of the air photographs that Huntings had flown.
So when you arrived at Prospect Point, was there nothing at all?
No, absolutely nothing. The most of that stretch of coastline were deeply indented bays, fed by glaciers, high ice cliffs, that sort of thing. And Prospect Point was one of the few places where there was, in fact, a rocky outcrop, which provided decent landing and potential for a base. There were one of only two or three potential locations down the whole coastline.
So the exact location was chosen really by Bill Johnson, was he, the captain, rather than by Fids?
I think it was probably a mutual decision. There was Ron Miller was the designated base leader. He was a sort of general assistant mountaineer, done quite a few good trips from base W. Angus Erskine, who had spent some time in the in Greenland, and myself and the skipper, you know, we sort of went ashore and then said, well, let's go and make a trip up what looked like a potential glacier up into the up onto the plateau. So my recollection was that certainly Angus, myself, Ron Miller skied for probably about 4 miles up the glacier from Base J, from Prospect Point, and it looked quite promising there. So he returned around, said, yeah, it looks like a good potential. And so the decision was made there and then to, this is where the base is going to be.
Was Fred Wooden with you at this point?
Yes, he was. He had previously been on the Danco base, on the Danco coast.
Yeah. What's confusing me is I interviewed Fred about 18 months ago, and he seemed to think that the concrete base for the hut was already in place when you arrived. But you, No, you made the concrete base, did you?
No, definitely, yeah. What happened before we went down, and as I said, there was mentioned earlier on, there was this little bit of a delay after we'd done our training and at the Directorate of Overseas Surveys. I actually went down to Bolt and Paul factory in Norwich, where the hut was pre-assembled, pre-cut, and all the different components were all given coded letters as to, you know, whether they were posts or beams or whatever. And we also had loaded on, they supplied, I believe, some ready-mix concrete, but it was called cement fondue, F-O-N-D-U, and C-I-M-E-N-T. I think it was a French product, but in fact, you could make, it was rare in that you could mix it with salt water to make concrete. So we definitely poured the bases and, you know, we made formwork cribbing for them and actually used some discarded oil drums, cut them at the right level sort of thing and filled those with concrete. And so we definitely poured the bases there. It may well be that Fred may have arrived on a second trip down there, by which time we had already laid the concrete bases.
Okay, that makes it clear. So yeah. Did the hut go up readily, bearing in mind you'd seen it already? Was it easy to construct?
The ship stayed alongside or anchored in the bay, and we used the scow for, you know, we still slept on board the Bisco, and it was a huge help in that we had, you know, the whole of the Fidge crew who were in transit to, A, offload the stores, and B, help pour the concrete and lay the foundations and put in the floor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At some stage, when it went off to relieve the other bases, some of the guys who were still in transit stayed behind with us until we were virtually sure that the hut was finishable. We'd got all the exterior up by the time the ship wasn't there all the time. It was still relieving the other bases. But its last visit was March, I think, and by which time they were, everyone was quite comfortable that we had shelter, and the six of us were able to finish the interior ourselves.
Mm. How was it to live in, Brian?
We lived in tents for quite a long spell, probably 6 weeks, I would think, while we were still building. We built a sort of, what was the routine at the time, was that we had an isolated storage area so that in the case of a fire, one still had some form of shelter and food and fuel. So this was remote from the actual hut itself. And we actually built the walls of cases of food, then put a tarpaulin over the top. And we used this as our cookhouse, but we slept in the tents.
And when you moved into the hut proper, was it comfortable? Did you enjoy living there?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was quite good. The interesting thing was that we had a wind-up gramophone record player at the time, and I have the recollection of the route at some stage. You know, we would all be asleep in the tents, and whoever had the gramophone would put on one which sticks in mind was. Joan Hammond singing "O Silver Moon," and you're lying in your tent, and they, you know, listening to this beautiful soprano voice sort of echoing out over the snow.
Was it five or six of you all together in the base?
Yes, six of us.
Yeah, and how did you all get on?
Very well. Different personalities, of course. But no conflict whatsoever. I suppose a couple of very, very minor disputes, but nothing significant. As I said, I think that was the one thing I learned there, to be reasonably tolerant of other people. But I thoroughly enjoyed, I think it was quite good. A lot of the stuff was disassembled. And so, for example, all the sledges, they didn't come as a complete sledge. They came as a kit form. So we had a huge workshop. Probably a third of the base hut was a workshop. And we had to assemble all the sledges together, this sort of thing. And it was quite neat working together, making it comfortable inside and painting it, et cetera, et cetera. And did you hit, were you aware about our generator problem and the radio?
Tell me about it.
Okay. Well, as I said, it was the maiden voyage of the John Biscoe. And one of the routine things that the ship's officers had to do when on watch was to measure the amount of water that was in the bilge of the boat. You know, they all leak through the different glands from the propeller shafts and that sort of thing. And what no one knew at the time was that so how you measure the water in the bilge, there's a vertical, probably a 2-inch pipe, went down from somewhere in the vicinity of the bridge down into the bilge of the boat. You dropped actually a lead line on the end of a length of rope down there, and then noted where the water level was on the line when you pulled it back up, and then operated the pumps until the water was below the level of the lead line. We didn't find out until we reached Port Stanley was that there was a kink in the pipe, you know, which may have been during the actual construction or it might have been during the loading. So the lead line never reached the bottom of the bilge. And well, when all the way down one thought that there was the bilges were dry and pumped dry every day, in fact, there was about 3 feet of water in the bottom of the hold. This spoiled quite a lot of the equipment that was designated for our base. A lot of the survey equipment, you know, some of the geological supplies, this sort of thing. Our theodolites were immersed in water, and the radio set, which was designed specifically for a small base, and the small generator that was due to power it, that was also immersed in water. We were able from stores in Port Stanley, able to replenish most of them, but not the radio. They found a spare radio at Deception Island, which was designed for a large base, a lot of personnel, and a large diesel generator, etc. This was the only radio available, so this was loaded on for us to use. After we'd built the hut and moved in, went to operate the radio, we found it absolutely took way too much power to operate. We would charge the batteries up for the generator for 24 hours, switch the radio on. Arthur Rumbelow, our radio operator, would sort of make contact, and after about 4 or 5 minutes, the batteries would go dead because this massive radio had taken too much power out of them. So we were virtually incommunicado, sort of thing. And we tried all sorts of things. We charged the batteries up for 2 days. We wouldn't have any lights on in the hut. We would just use candles and hurricane lamps to conserve the power. Switch the radio on, the same thing. Last about 4 or 5 minutes and then drain the batteries. So Arthur was a typical of quite a lot of the radio ops in the south. was an avid ham operator. But he, and he also brought with him quite a lot of radio magazines. And he came to us after another frustrating session, said, look, he said, I think I might be able to build a small radio that would get us in contact. But I need to cannibalize a lot of the parts off the existing radio. He said, I've bought some all sorts of things down with me, transistors and coils and Lord knows what. So I think I could make a radio, but if it doesn't work, well, there's no way I can put it back together again into the big radio. So we debated this and said, well, nothing to lose, go for it. So he got a Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin, got his soldering iron out, sort of cannibalized several parts of this immense radio, which probably stood about, I don't know, 5 foot high by 3 feet deep sort of thing, and assembled all these parts into his little Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin, and which absorbed very, very, very little power, and said, well, this is it, the big day, let's see if it works. And sure enough, it did. And we were in communication with everybody, with all the bases, with Port Stanley. We even got the BBC overseas broadcast to the Antarctic and everything.
So that was at a worrying time then, that you might have been out of touch for the year?
Yes, yeah. That was it. The following year, I believe that they did bring down the smaller radios that were designated for the bases. But the other thing that it also made a difference was our sledging radios were also damaged, and we had difficulty in communicating when we were on sledge trips.
Was Arthur able to do anything about that?
Unfortunately, no. I think we'd run out of Huntley & Palmer's biscuit tins.